Today is Wednesday. It's February 24th, 2021. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Mulleady Meekum. Last name spelled Mulleady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Tom.
Well, great to hear it. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. Nancy,
you said jump in. I was going to make a quick clarification. In the last tape, I had talked about in 1986 working as a paramedic for mobile life support in California for 7 months, and I just wanted to clarify that was in Santa Barbara County.
Okay.
So I just, you know, Solvang, Los Olivos, Santa Maria, Guadalupe, that area, so Santa Barbara. So I just wanted to say that I worked many different counties in California as a paramedic in the off season. So
cool.
Okay.
All right. Well, I was going to do an introduction and just say, you know, go from there. So I'll do that. Which is, last time we talked about you working at Death Valley, assigned out of Furnace Creek, I think from October of 1989 to April of 1990, and. What happened in April of 1990?
April of 1990, that's when the season for seasonals is completed because it's about to get warm. Not that many people go to this, quote, winter park, so they go down just to their skeleton crew staff of permanent employees.
I see.
So I went to teach park medic again at VMC, and I did that for many, many years. I would go finish in one place and go teach the park medic class right before I started at Sequoia National Park, which is where I went in 1990. And again, worked there as a park ranger naturalist and a paramedic at Sequoia National Park. And then when I finished that, I returned that fall. Let me see if I've got this correct now. I was looking at this. So at the end of that, I worked as a seminar instructor. I'm sorry, I should be more up on this. I'm looking at these different things here. Finishing that in the fall and of 1990. And then 91, went back to Death Valley. And then I'm a little bit off on the dates here, but that's when the... Yes, January of 91 is when my fiancé, not quite the year and a half before fiancé, but Kent, he received a job offer at the Grand Canyon. So when I was at Death Valley, he received an offer to be the structural fire chief at Grand Canyon. So he transferred as a permanent, and then I also went to the Grand Canyon at that time. His name was Kent Meekum, M-E-C-H-N. It is Kent Meekum, M-E-C-H-A-M. And so when I went there, I then began to work all year round as a seasonal. If you recall, I got my, quote, golden key, my status, by working at Fort Ord as a paramedic for the Department of the Army as a civilian. When you get that status, as long as you're working for the government, your clock to get rid of the status of 3 years stops. But it also allows you to work year round without having the problems with being a seasonal. So now, beginning in 1991, in January, I went to the Grand Canyon, and because it was wintertime, I worked as a seasonal naturalist for Chuck Waller, W-A-H-L-E-R, who I think was the finest supervisor I've ever had.
Tell me about Chuck.
Chuck, I'm still in touch with him now.
Cool.
He and his wife, Sally, he was the ranger in charge of interpretation or naturalist at the south rim of the Grand Canyon, working underneath the chief naturalist or chief of interpretation. And when I worked for Chuck, he was very open to new ideas. I worked out of Yavapai Museum, which was the geology museum, so our focus was giving the geology talks, how the Grand Canyon came to be. but he was open to doing anything else, and he was inspiring. And when, just to give you an idea of the kind of person he was, and I thought, Kent had asked me to marry him, and I had asked him for some time off. And when I went to ask him for time off, I thought, well, I'll ask for, you know, a week, maybe 10 days at the most. And, you know, because, you know, you're during the season. It was April. That's a busy time, you know. And so I went to him, and I said, Chuck, you know, we're getting married, as you know. And I said, we'd like to have some time off for a honeymoon. And I asked him, I said, could I have a week? And he goes, are you sure that's enough? Don't you need 2 weeks? And I said, well, I would really like to have 2 weeks. He goes, you take 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it's from Chuck Waller that I learned, and when I was later a supervisor, that if you take care of the people, the rest is taken care of.
Yeah.
If you screw the people, everything messes up.
Right.
And so, to me, I would do anything for Chuck. And I did. I worked extra days when people didn't work. I was the acting supervisor for a while at Yavapai Museum. When an SDA came in, I trained them. Yeah, that's a lot of extra duties for no extra pay, but I wanted to do it for Chuck. You know, I wanted to do it for the operation. And he, like I said, we're still in touch. His kids were very young at the time. And so when they would go on vacation, they would stay at our house with Kent and I.
Nice.
And I think that Jacob was maybe 4 at the time, and Aaron maybe 7. And it was great to have them over, and then they'd come back, and they'd go back to their house. And later grew up with that. You know, the family grew up, and when Jacob came over, I think he was 12 or 13 at the time, because I was working on my backyard with my dog and trying to get rid of all these rocks and stuff. And I'll hire Jacob to do this, and I had hired him to help me train my dog. And so we're out there picking up rocks and throwing them over the fence, and he's reciting the Torah to me.
Wow.
Because his bar mitzvah is coming up, you know, and he and he goes, how does that sound, Nance? And I said, sounds great, Jacob. I have no clue what you're saying, but it sounds good. So it was just a wonderful family. Later I went to his wedding.
Aaron,
I just sent another card to. So it's the family that we adopted each other, and it was just so important for me at that time.
Nice.
My life, for so many things. So anyway, Chuck and Sally Waller were wonderful. So I worked there in the wintertime at Yavapai Geology Museum. And then when it came to the end of that season, I had applied for, and they picked me up quite quickly since I was a paramedic, as a South Rim Protection Ranger. And that meant South Rim Patrol during the daytime. The benefit of that is I also got to be a horse patrol ranger, and I've been riding since I was 3 years old. My uncle had a ranch, and we used to ride all the time, and I remember one of my earliest memories. I mean, I have a picture of me at 3 years old on a horse, and my uncle told us, Sam's getting old, don't ride double on Sam. So my older brother Tom said, well, let's ride 3 of us in. That's not 2. So we all got on Sam, and we were immediately bucked off. And so I learned after that not to listen to my brother, Tom. But I've been riding ever since. You know, even today I still lead backcountry seminars for Horse Creek Pack Station. So being on horse patrol was really good. You went through the training. It was really very wonderful. It was much more of a public relations thing. But I would gallop the calls, and I would be there for people. So it was just an ideal situation for me. And when you're on day shift at the Grand Canyon, as opposed to night shift, which I later worked as well when I became a permanent, the day shift is more public relations, people's problems, separated parties, emergency medical services, search and rescue, all the things that I wanted to do as a ranger. Later on, when I became a permanent, when you went to the night shift, now that's more of law enforcement, more of people's negative problems, not just separated parties. People who are using medications or drugs, and people who are becoming intoxicated. In the wintertime, it was the worst when I was on night shift in the wintertime, because that's when you had a lot of domestic violence situations. Shorter days, longer nights, people getting in arguments, intoxicated. So it really was not the best situation. But if I had to pick one, being day shift summer as opposed to day shift winter was perfect for me.
Uh-huh.
So in this time from 91 to 92, I was hired as a subject to furlough position, meaning I had time off. And in the time off, I worked for Chuck at the Yavapai Museum because I had status.
Okay.
So here I worked. It was a little frustrating at first. My supervisor was a man named Mike Myers. And I, is Tom spelled his last name M-E-Y or M-Y?
M-Y-E-R-S. I think I can look it up.
Okay, so this Mike Myers is M-E-Y-E-R-S. It's same pronunciation, but different spelling.
Uh-huh.
He was a supervisor, and he was a little bit, he was kind of a control guy. He was a good guy, but he was kind of control. So I had just come from Death Valley where we were doing all this stuff, motor vehicle accidents, and climbing on cliffs, and doing all this stuff, and you wear, you know, your jeans to do all this. He wanted us to wear Class A wool pants all the time, unless we were on horse patrol. And I thought, we have to get these dry cleaned. They get ripped really easy. Blood does not come out well. So that was something we went around with. But he won, of course, because he's the supervisor. So, we wore our Class A wools, and we looked good, but, you know, it just wasn't enough in the uniform allowance. Several years later, we got to wear jeans after we all started submitting our bills to him for replacement pants. So that worked for a while, I guess. But anyway, so I worked a lot. Because I was the only paramedic on the day shift, there was another one by the name of Brian Smith who was on the night shift, and there were some park medics amongst the staff, but not on the day shift. I should also clarify at this time, all the calls that dispatch sent to South Rim went to Mike Myers, and then he assigned somebody to go to it. That's how it worked when I first started there.
Oh, that's odd. So instead of dispatch
going to the shift supervisor or the individual ranger, all the calls went to Mike Myers.
Huh.
And then he assigned people. So for quite some time, I got all the medicals, and I didn't get to do the investigations, and I didn't do this, and I didn't, you know, maybe I'll do a. We also did lockouts in cars, so when people would leave their keys in their cars, there was no locksmith in the early years. So we went to training. We learned how to put Slim Jims into cars, use wires, and do all kinds of stuff. And so we used to, I guess I can tell the story. We used to do things like when you call on scene, you'd say, dispatch, I was 526 at the time, 526 on scene. And then you'd go unlock the car, and you talk to the people for a little bit. You go back to your car, and you say, 526 available. Well, all that took amount of time, and you wanted to show people how good you were at this. So you got on scene. You said, 526 on scene. You said, hi. You opened the car door, and you said, I'm available. And then you talked to the people. So it made it sound like you just got, boom, you just got it done real well. So there was a little competition about how fast you could open a car. I could open almost any car back then. So it was pretty cool to be able to do that. And this happens especially if there's somebody with a baby in the car. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but usually it's people who lock their keys in the car or lock them in the trunk or something like that. Another call that was happening early on, and this is a call I told you about off tape that I wanted to remember, and I'm glad I'm remembering it now, is we have a district ranger whose name I'm not going to give you. Benjamin. And he was not a nice person to women. And he was, you know, we always had to wear our flat hat. We always had to look sharp in our uniform. And I had just stepped out of my car at the parking area outside of Ranger Operations, which is where our headquarters was. And I was reaching in to get my hat. And he says, Melidi, which was my last name at the time, get your hat on. You know, I was getting it, but. You know, he was the kind of person who would just yell at you and then look real mean and walk away. And not a really good guy, in my opinion, in terms of caring about me as a person, as a ranger. He took care of the guys a lot better than he took care of me, but it's just life. But anyway, one of the things that used to drive him crazy, and he wanted us to get on it, was that there were groups of people who came up. Some of them were with a group called Talk Tours, T-A-U-C-K, but there were many other people that did this. Usually they were students or kids, teenagers or young adults, and they were not from America. They were from Australia. They were from all over the world, and they desperately wanted to take a license plate from America home as a souvenir.
Ah.
And so when somebody would take a license plate, the people would report it to the rangers. Not only did we have to take a report, but we have to put it in the national report database, which took a lot of work.
Oh, wow.
In case a bad guy had actually stolen it to use it to rob a bank.
Hmm.
We knew they were being taken for souvenirs, but we couldn't cut this short, you know, just in case. So each one of those was time-consuming, a lot of paperwork. This is before computers, so we were doing it by hand, typing it on a typewriter.
Wow.
And so it was, and it just, because that consumed a whole lot of our time, not so much the call, but the follow-up. Benjamin just went crazy over this, and so did we. So one day, I am driving through the Bright Angel parking lot, just kind of patrolling around, and I see a young man, maybe 18 years of age, at the back of a car with a screwdriver unscrewing a license plate. And I said, I got him. So I put it in the park, and I called it in, and I said, stop what you're doing. And he looked at me, and he took off. And I took off after him. And I'm running so fast that I'm just within a foot of him. And the alarm bell comes out. You know, report of a woman with difficulty breathing. So Mike Myers calls me and sends me on the call. And I didn't catch the guy.
Wow.
Dang. I was this close, you know. So anyway. That was the, I'll never forget running for maybe a quarter mile after this guy.
Wow.
And getting closer and closer. One of the things you're taught, and I've used it several times, is you never tackle anybody in law enforcement, despite what you see on television.
Right.
You get close enough to push them. Just push them so they're off center and they fall down into the gravel and the dust and all that stuff. Then you come to a halt and you pick up the pieces.
Right.
So the stuff where you tackle people on TV is, that's not what we're taught, and that's not what I was taught. And I've used that technique several times, and it's worked really well for me.
Okay.
And I was just about to push him. But anyway.
It was interesting thinking about the night and day difference between, as you mentioned, Chuck Waller as your interpretive boss, and the district ranger as another boss in a different position, and the night and day difference between these people.
Right, and then the day shift supervisor, who was Mike Myers, who you know, to me, I believe he was gender blind. I don't think I had any issues with Mike Myers. He just wanted the person to do that, and I finally went to him. I said, you know what? I'm not just a paramedic. I can do investigations. I can do all this stuff. So slowly but surely, I got to do other calls.
Okay.
But that took a long time, and then finally. For whatever reason, they decided that, because what they would do is, we had a lot of people there. They had, I think it was 3 or 4 permanent rangers, and they would hire for the season, for if it was in the summer season, 3 or 4 seasonals to, or maybe it was 3 seasonals to go with those. I'm trying to remember, 3 permanents and 3 seasonals? I think it was. And so you were really flush in the summertime, and then really not enough people in the wintertime. But so they decided to take the subject deferral position I was in and turn it into a full-time permanent job. And I objected to that because I liked my time off to go work for Chuck and to do other things. And I was developing and giving evening programs and stuff. So I didn't have any course. You know, they changed it to a permanent full-time position. The big drawback to this was, now I am 365 days of a year a protection ranger, and the real drawback to it is I was protection in the summer in the day shift, and I worked the nights in the winter instead of working day shift as a naturalist. So for 6 months of the year, I didn't see my husband practically.
Oh.
And that was really awful. But I did that for many years, and but it made me unhappy, because when I would work either shift, you'd still get called out during the day on a general alarm. You'd still get called out for a hostage situation. You'd get called out for a structural fire. So you really had, they talk about a young and vigorous workforce. And I agree that's what you need at that time, but it should be on an individual basis and not an age basis. They tell you to retire at 55 from these positions when some people might be able to go further. But I easily worked 70 hours a week because of my skills. And what I had done over time is protection, is I developed my skills in each one of the broad categories or the categories that had to make a protection ranger. So number one is law enforcement. So eventually I went back to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia. Once I became a permanent, they sent you back there for 4 months. And this is before 9/11, so you went to school 5 days a week. And then on weekends, I went and explored. You know, I went down to Vero Beach, Florida, and watched a spring training game for the Dodgers. I went to Charleston, South Carolina. I went to Plains, Georgia, and got to meet Jimmy Carter.
Wow.
You got to do all these different things. After 9/11, you went to school 6 days a week and no time off.
Wow.
And I felt sorry, and it was very accelerated. So I felt sorry for those people. But it was a really good school to go to. At the time, also, I shared it with other land management agencies. I should look at the picture to be specific. But this was law enforcement for land management agencies. So it included National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, Department of Defense, Tennessee Valley of Authority.
Wow.
I had a guy from the Navy, quite a few people. And so it was just what you expect a police school to be. You know, you did workouts and calisthenics, and you did mock trials where you were the prosecutor. You did investigations. You did interrogations. You did fingerprinting. You went to classes for the law. It really was thorough and very good. But because we were kind of diverse, you would see another group of students in another class, and they would all be border patrollers.
Hmm.
And, and you know, or they'd all be somebody else. So they'd be Department of the Treasury, not Secret Service, I'm trying to remember whoever the Department of the Treasury was. Anyway, somebody else. So we were the most diverse, and we had a softball team, and we had a really good time. But we were warned if we twisted our ankle or something that we would have to go home. And if you don't get your go through FLETC, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, then you lose your job because then you don't have your commission anymore.
Wow.
Because you didn't finish school.
Right.
So when I went to go to FLETC, they had changed the rules so that you had to, the first day you were there, pass the physical equivalency battery, the PEB. And the first day, if you didn't pass the PEB, you were sent home.
Wow.
And there was a ranger, I don't have to name him, but he worked at Meadview. He was sent to FLETC, didn't pass it, he was sent home.
Wow.
And he didn't get to go back for 2 years, and he never got permanent status until he got all that. It was just a mess. So you were really on your toes. So what I had done is, before I went, is I worked out, and I ran every day, and I did my obstacle course, and I did my lifting, all the things you have to do to pass the PEB. And so I'm driving across country in my van, and I get to New Orleans in February, and this is like only my second hotel driving across country to go to Georgia. This is in Glencoe, Georgia. And so I went to a Motel 6 to get a room, and it was $184. I said, excuse me. And Mardi Gras was on.
Oh, wow.
So everything was inflated. So I just continued to sleep in my van as I went across. And I remember in New Orleans running around the parking lot, running. So in driving across country.
To try to keep your fitness up as you went across the country. Wow.
Right. So we met the first day. We went over to the gym. We got all – they supply everything for you, including bras, you know, everything.
Okay.
Your socks, your everything. So you don't wear anything. If they don't supply it, you don't wear it.
Wow.
And so you put on your stuff, and then you turn it in every day, and the next day you have fresh stuff. But so we got out there, and we're doing everything. And I'm running the track, and I, you know, come up, and they told me the time, and I'd taken a minute and a half off my time, and I thought, wow, that is really good. But it occurred to me I trained at 7,000 feet at the south rim of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And here I'm, you know, got oxygen-rich sea level.
Sea level.
Georgia.
Oh, my gosh. So, and you took a minute and a half off your time? Wow.
I did. I think I was also scared to death.
Oh, gosh.
So after that, I did fine. I did very well. I did 2 out of 3 top of the class. I was a very good shooter. So I got my marksman certificate. I was very good at the didactic, the law, schoolwork.
That sounds fun. I mean, to learn about the law that way, I think it's real
Oh, I
important.
loved it.
Everybody
I
should go
loved
through
it.
that training.
And the people who are treating or are training you are all top of the people. I remember we had an assistant U.S. attorney teaching us the law.
Wow.
You know, it was just amazing all the stuff that you learn. And then we went to driving school. And you learn to drive around corners while talking on the radio. And
Wow.
learn to brake and, you know, decelerate into curves and accelerate out of curves. And I'll never forget when we did this as a seasonal at Bob Bondurant that I got the award for driving faster backwards than I did forward through the obstacle course.
Oh, gee.
It's all, I guess I'm good with mirrors or something.
Mm.
But, you know, we did all of that. And the camaraderie that you build up with people in that class is really something. It's really neat.
Do you remember any of the people that you went to
Oh,
FLETC with
yeah.
that are still?
Oh, yeah. Lawrence was my driving partner, and we have several people. You know, they try to put the ladies together. Lindy was my partner when it came to battering each other. We'd put a big red suit on, which was full padding, and then you just wail at the other person. You know, and so it's like sumo wrestlers going
Yeah.
at each other, but that way we could hit each other with full force. And several times during this, people would get a cut lip or something like that, and I'd have gloves available, and I went and took care of them because they figured out early on I was a paramedic. But I remember we were at the jail, the pretend jail that they had there, and they had just arrested somebody and to take brought somebody in. So we learned to do everything there, and the instructor. She went to open a window and it wouldn't open. It was stuck, and she pushed really hard with the heel of her palm, and her hand went through the window and she cut the artery.
Go.
I mean, it was really bad. So I kept my gloves on top of my handcuffs in that container. So I put them on and did direct pressure. She goes, "Don't call the doctor on campus. I'm fine." I said, "No, I think you're not so fine." So we took. She got stitches. She was fine after that. But anyway, so it was a very positive experience. But a couple things that I remember most about it was at nighttime, as it got warmer, I would go outside the building because you lived in these dorms. And I shared my bathroom with a lady from Bureau of Land Management, I think it was. And then I would go outside and sit against the building away from the lights that were on the building as best I could and watch the fireflies.
Wow.
Because being from California, I'd only seen fireflies one other time in my life that I remembered, you know. I lived in Maryland for 2 years, but I don't remember the fireflies. So
Wow.
that was very special. And it was so wet and muggy, and it was
Georgia.
very special.
Yeah.
It was Georgia. And I got to learn, you know, the South, and it was really fun. And I had some family living in Georgia, so I got to visit them on weekends.
Oh,
So
cool.
anyway, Kent drove out for grad or flew out for graduation.
Oh,
And
fun.
then we drove back together. So he got to be there at my graduation. So that was very good. So
What year was
anyway,
that?
that was nine. Oh, do I have it on here? I want to say 93, but I don't have it on here. But that's my guess.
Okay. All right.
That's my guess. Took me 2 years from the time I got my position, I think, till I went. Oh, here it is. Nope, it was 96.
Oh.
Wow. Yeah. It was February to May of 1996.
okay, and that allows you with the graduation from FLETC, that allows you to become a commissioned officer, is that right?
Well, a fully commissioned officer,
Okay.
as opposed to a seasonal. Okay,
Right, right.
and now the biggest thing I can do is serve warrants and do investigations.
Okay.
Seasonals are not trained, nor are they allowed to do that. Unbeknownst to me, this also opened a huge door 4 years later when the Twin Towers were attacked.
Okay.
And after the Twin Towers were attacked, and suddenly there were threats to dams and buildings, you know, like the Treasury buildings and all this kind of stuff, they needed a lot more federal law enforcement officers to figure out what's going to be attacked next. You just don't get them out of the woodwork. There's only so many openings at FLETC. So what they did is they took anybody with a full law enforcement commission that worked for the government and put them on Homeland Security detail.
Wow, okay.
And we all rotated through them. And that's when I did some pretty hardcore law enforcement, when I went to go protect dams and do other things like that.
Okay.
We'll
get there.
Came back,
yeah.
I came back. They do a full background investigation, which I believe they have to renew. At that time, I had to renew every 2 or 3 years.
And they didn't do that before you went?
No, they did. They might have done it before.
Okay.
But before they can give you the full commission, they have to do it again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they did it for a seasonal one.
Okay.
And then every year you go through 40 hours of continuing education. And I still remember one of the most important things I learned in one of those 40-hour classes. And it's a case called Giglio Henshorn, and I'll try to spell it, Giglio Henshorn.
Thank you.
And Giglio Henshorn case was, this was a, and I don't even know if he was a federal officer, but he was a law enforcement person, and he would go arrest somebody for DUI and testify against that person, arrest somebody for theft and testify against that person, as we all do when we follow up on our cases.
Mm-hmm.
Some smart lawyer one time looked at the background of this person before he testified against his client, found out he got in trouble for, I think it was cheating on his taxes, or running a business without the correct contract. He did something illegal, but only got slapped on the wrist, you know, got a fine or something like that, and got to continue doing that. So when he went on the stand to this case, and I can't remember if the officer's name was Giglio or Henshorn, but anyway, the defense lawyer so destroyed his credibility by saying, well, since you lied about this, why aren't you lying about my client now?
Mm.
And it got to the point where it was so bad that he eventually lost his job because he couldn't testify against anybody he arrested.
Wow.
Because of this background.
Okay.
So Giglio or Henshorn was something that held law enforcement officers, and in particular, we federal law enforcement officers, to a much higher standard, that if you want to be able to do your job, arrest and testify against people, you must keep yourself very clean.
Okay.
And I was always a good kid before then, but now really, I didn't want, you know, no, here, you want a free Coke? No, thank you very much. You know, I didn't want to do anything that would mess up my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure people did, but didn't get caught. But Giglio Henshorn changed everything in terms of the ability to be a dual person.
So you couldn't have any felony offenses against you, clearly,
not even misdemeanors.
Not even misdemeanors. I'm lying. Okay.
I should also clarify the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. Both of them are criminal acts. The penalty is which decides which is a misdemeanor and which is a felony.
I see.
A misdemeanor is, and it used to be, no more than $1,000 fine and no more than a year in jail. That's what made it a misdemeanor.
Okay.
All felonies are over $1,000 fines and over a year in jail. And that's the only thing that made them different. The misdemeanor changed with the Archaeological Resources Protection Act, ARPA, because those were misdemeanors to take those Oyas and pots and things from archaeological sites. Those
mm-hmm.
are misdemeanors.
Right.
But if you're taking something that you can then sell for $10,000, it's worth $1,000 fine to a lot of people.
Mm.
So that got changed under the Code of Federal Regulations, that you can fine people, I guess, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Mm.
And so that gave ARPA some strength.
Still under a misdemeanor.
It's still a misdemeanor, though, because it's the punishment for the crime.
Right.
So misdemeanor is less than a year. And to give you an idea, and so you probably know that there's criminal law and that there's civil law. And civil law is not against the public entity, the state, the county, or the federal government. It's against another person when you're trying to get redress. But what do you do if something's gone wrong and it's not a crime and it's not against another person? So that's what's called a tort, T-O-R-T, and that is a wrong. So So you're driving through Yosemite National Park. A windstorm is happening. A tree branch breaks off and smashes into your car. Well, it's not a crime, but it's against the federal government's tree. What do? You file a tort because it was a wrong to redress, to get your redress.
Right.
So anyway, I learned a lot about the law and really enjoyed
that's,
it.
That's fascinating because I know that, the tort claims played a role back in the 30s and 40s when the park was trying to figure out how to manage river runners. Because they came to the decision that if somebody was on a commercial tour, they couldn't file a tort claim. They would have to sue the commercial operator.
Yeah, because they were under contract through the park. And one of the other things, and it was kind of a big secret for a long time, and I don't know when it began or even if it's ever ended, but if it was a big-time tort claim, like wrongful death or something, and it was filed, or even not that, they would often settle it out of court because the court costs would be so much more expensive. So people began to know to sue the government, let's say for $50,000 if they only wanted $15,000, and then they would settle for $15,000. And people knew to not ask for the 15, but ask for so much more so they'd get a settlement.
Got it. Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, anyway.
Interesting history there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, I became a permanent full-time protection ranger.
Okay.
And so the things that I did, and I worked very hard, so law enforcement, I got my full law enforcement commission. And so also, I should also say that I also transitioned between 1991 and 1996, the first sidearm I ever was issued was a .38 revolver. Then when I went to the Grand Canyon, I was issued a .357 Magnum revolver with Magnum rounds, which means they have a little more power to them.
What's the weight difference between those two weapons?
Oh, huge.
Wow.
And it wasn't the weight difference. One of the and I was a very good shot, and the way that shoot is you don't look at the target. The target's out of focus. You line up the front of the side of the pistol with the back side of the pistol, and whatever you're shooting at is kind of out of focus in the back. When people look at the target, that's when they miss it.
Oh, interesting.
And so
makes sense.
That, and the problem with the .357 Magnum, when you also had to practice shooting at nighttime. So we would do our day shooting, and we'd either wait around or we'd come back when it got to a certain darkness. That .357 with the Magnum load, the first shot was so bright it blinded you.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, the flame, literally,
yeah.
flame
yeah.
that came out of the gun. So then you had to get it, you usually double tap or shoot twice. And it was really hard to because when the gun shot, you're strong, but it's not exactly right on target, so you have to bring it back on target. But here you're a little blind, so you kind of learn to squint a little bit and all.
Oh, because you know the flash is coming. Yeah.
Right, right. So the next gun that was issued to it was the Sig Sauer.
Okay.
And we had our pick between three different Sig Sauers with large law enforcement loads, magazines.
Okay.
So normally a gun has, I don't even know what a normal gun has, seven in the magazine, and we would have like 10 or 11 in the magazine.
Okay.
And so, and then one in the chamber. And so you could either get a 9mm or you could get a 40mm, or you could get a 45. And the 45 Sig Sauer pistol, semi-automatic, meaning it's not a revolver anymore. It comes up, you shoot it, and then instead of retaining the cartridge, the bullet's gone on its way, the cartridge is now ejected onto the ground. And so it's semi-automatic in that it reloads, puts another one in the chamber, ready for you to shoot.
So it'll fire as fast as you can pull the trigger.
Pull the trigger, as opposed to holding a trigger down and having it still fire. That's an automatic.
Okay.
So we transitioned to that, and so the range master at the time was Mark Law.
Okay.
He was a good guy, and we would go and we would have to qualify twice a year, and so we all had our new weapons and how to do this, and I had a 9mm, and he had a 45.
Okay.
And he was trying to tell everybody how much more load and firepower is in a 45, and how a 9 is wissy and whoopy. The reason I had a 9 was because my hand was smaller than most guys.
Mm-hmm.
And in the nine is smaller. So he said, you know, and I was the only one with a nine. Almost everybody else had a 45. And so I challenged him to a pepper popper.
Okay.
And what those are steel plates that are in a circle that if you hit them, they swing around to the other side. And if you then you hit it and it swings around to the other side. And then there were, we put balloons up and stuff like that. And I beat him.
Hmm.
And I said, Mark, it's not the power, it's where you put it.
Right. And
yeah,
also,
very accurate.
You know, you have to carry that weapon on your duty belt along with extra ammunition and you know, a whole host of other tools.
You haven't heard the beginning of it. Another female ranger and I, we were at the Hella base one day. And, you know, we had body armor on with a metal plate. We had our duty belt with our gun, our baton, our everything on a radio.
Yep.
We had our boots on, you name it.
Pepper spray, maybe. Yeah.
Oh, everything. And you could not, there was not an empty space on it.
Right.
And so we took all that off and put on the scale. And for me, it was 22 pounds, and for her, it was 21 pounds.
So what was she doing 1 pound better than you? Because that's important. Did you guys work it out? Huh.
I don't know.
I would love doing that at the clinic, would be to get law enforcement officers.
I think it was close. I think it was just, you know, within a couple hours.
Yeah, to weigh their belts. And they got into it, and they were like, well, wait a minute. How come, you know, your belt is 3 pounds lighter than mine? And they try to figure these things out, whether it was different.
Yeah,
you know,
we were more appalled about what we were carrying than what the
Yes, absolutely. So there's a 22-pound backpack that you're wearing every day or every night.
On your hips.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so anyway, I had a 9mm. I was very good at pulling it, very good at doing what I needed to do, always qualified.
Mm.
It was easily one of the best shots out there. And it sounds like I'm blowing my own horn, but to me, it was important to be capable in what I did.
Right.
And not just be, you know, it's like I tell my EN2 students, do you want somebody working on you who only knew 75% of the material?
Right.
What about the other 25%? So
right.
I wanted to be very good at what I did, and I was good at investigations and investigating people and fingerprinting and doing crime scene investigations. We also did traffic vehicle accident investigations where, you know, you got out the protractor and you measured stuff and you figured out from the skid mark how fast they were going.
Hmm.
If I was going to do this job, I wanted to be good at it.
Right.
I didn't necessarily wanted to do law enforcement, but to do the other things, this is what I was going to do, and I was going to be good at it.
Yes.
So that was one thing. So that was law enforcement.
Yeah.
So the next one is going to be structural fire.
Okay. Before we do structural fire, can you tell me a Mark Law story?
Mark Law was married to Barb
Horning?
Horning.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I should tell the story, but I remember it was like my first or second day there, and I came in, and Barb was working for John Benjamin, and I think she was the clerk, and I walked in, and the words coming out of that room between Mark and Barb were just, oh, my God, it would make a sailor blush. Later on, when I found out they were married, I was appalled. But then you'd see them together, and everything was fine, but it was just like, I could never have a relationship with somebody like that.
Hmm.
Mark was very good at carving bears and polishing bears. I, to this day, have 7 of his bears on my windowsill. He was very good at that. He was very fair. He was my boss for a little while when he was acting something or other. He later became the River District Ranger, I think it was.
Right.
And, but that was, I think he was, my interactions with him were for the most part positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he also was one of those gender blind people. If you could do the job, that's fine. Oh, this is the biggest deal. There was a time when we had the Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of the Interior was Lujan, and the Director of the National Park Service, Ridenour, and a bunch of associate directors who were going to go down the Colorado River.
Okay.
And they were going to go down as far as, what's that place where they send the helicopter in?
Whitmore Wash?
Whitmore Wash, I think it was. Or maybe it was Phantom Ranch. I can't remember.
Okay.
But anyway, we started up at Lee's Ferry. And because, and I guess I can say that now because I think he's passed away, the Secretary of the Interior had a heart attack in the past.
Okay.
And so they wanted me to go as a paramedic. And I was the only woman on the trip. And so Mark was the coordinator of the trip. And so he was a very good person to work with. And I enjoyed working with him on that. He loaned me some of his river shorts, I remember, that fit me because I didn't have the waterproof kind of ones. I just had hiking shorts, you know. And I wore my first ever Tevas on that trip.
Cool.
And the Secretary of the Interior did, in fact, injure himself at one point. He dislocated his finger, which I relocated and splinted for him. And so after that, he was riding a rubber ducky.
Good for him.
Which is sitting in a blow-up thing, but I with a rope towing behind. And somehow he got his hand caught in the rope or something.
Yeah.
And then, but before that happened, I remember two things that really, the administration was not positive toward national parks at the time. And so it was very conservative. And so I was just being not conservative. I was, you know, just on my edge, keeping my mouth shut. So I'm carrying one of those great big tables, not the little skinny ones, one of those great big tables up the boats, all the way up the landing and up the sand. And he runs up and he tries to take it out of my hands and goes, "That's no job for a girl." And I said, "Oh, but it is for a woman." And I just kept walking up with him.
Well, good for you.
And there was another time we were going to go up. It wasn't Matt Katamiba, but it was a different. No, maybe it was Matt Katamiba that we were going to go up there, which I is my favorite canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd seen enough. He goes, "If you've seen one canyon, you've seen them all."
Wow.
So I went, okay. So anyway, that was neither here nor there. And yeah. But it was a once they Dave DeRocher was on the trip. Another David who later was on Paul David. What was his name? Not David. I'm trying to remember his name.
How do you spell DeRocher's last name?
DeRocher, I think.
Okay.
There was also a guy named Dutch, but I can't remember his real name. We called him that because he said his dog called him that. He was a river guide for the Park Service. And there was another guy, but his name is just not going.
Deutschlander. Mind, Doug Deutschlander might have been
Doug
there.
Doug Deutschlander. Yeah.
How do you spell Deutschlander?
You spell it.
Oh, no, I
don't know. Deutschlander, DeUtschlander. I don't know.
That's good. Thank you.
I couldn't even remember his last name, but you did. So anyway, we're on this river trip, and then we drop them off, and off they fly away. So it's just like the three of us on this boat, and we go through lava together and everything. And I sat on the front on the pontoon, and we just had a great time. And I remember Dave going up some cliff and jumping into the water, and it was just... after being so careful and so perfect for the time we had these people, it was just really nice. I don't drink alcohol. I never have. And I just, you know, those guys were very good and everybody was very good except for, you know, I don't know. I never saw anybody drunk on a trip.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very nice to see their professionalism. But after that, then we just, you tell the stories you tell that you would never tell in front of other people. Can you believe that? And all that kind of stuff. And then we went to lava and we were fine.
Cool.
And,
structural fire.
Structural fire.
Unless you have more Mark Law stories.
I can't. They might come up later on. But
yeah.
He was not the most people of people persons, but he was fair.
Yes.
In my opinion.
Yes.
And then, let's see, In structural fire, I'd gotten my basic firefighter one at Santa Rosa Criminal Justice Training Center on a weekend. And then when I went to Death Valley and worked my first season in protection, I got my firefighter two. Kent was collateral. He was the sub-district ranger. His collateral duty was the structural fire chief at Death Valley. And that's... I believe it was 91, he taught a Firefighter 2 class. So Firefighter 1 is you learn about everything, you learn about the hose and use about stuff, but you don't learn about the self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, and go into burning buildings.
Okay.
And you don't learn how to size things up and all that kind of stuff. So the Firefighter 2 class is really encompassing. Now you can do all of this stuff. and Kent was a national instructor. He went back. He also designed fire engines and went back to Pennsylvania and brought them back after he designed them for whichever park he was working at. He was,
wow.
He was quite talented at that. So he would also go to different park areas and teach Firefighter 1 and 2 for people as well. He also taught officers' classes and pump engineers' class, which I later did take. But so when I got to the Grand Canyon, I was a Firefighter 2, got my turnouts, also known as bunkers, which is the flame-resistant clothing that you wear. So the procedure would be we were still at the old – there is at this time at the Grand Canyon a fire station over by the clinic. The old fire station was over in the maintenance yard across from the collection. And so if a fire came out, you drove up, if you were on duty, you drove up in your patrol car, you took your duty belt off, and you put it in the trunk of your car and you locked it because you didn't have lockable lockers. You went inside, you quick stripped down, put on your bunkers, you jumped in the seat, and at that time, as a firefighter too, I would go with one with an SCBA on. You would then put it on, turn on your air, check everything, have your Nomax hood ready, depending upon the call. Then you would put on your hearing protection, which was also an intercom, and the captain in the front seat would say, okay, Nancy, you're going to pull the 5-inch and you're going to wrap the hydrant, or, you're going to take the one, you're going to take the disconnect, the 50-foot disconnect, and you're going to connect it over here. So you got your assignments as you drove there, as we heard more and more about the call was.
Okay.
So that's what I did. And then when I believe, like, I don't remember years of stuff. I can only give you kind of a progression of things.
Mm-hmm.
But when I became, I then went to officer school. And so I learned to be a captain, and then I was a captain. And so now I would sit in the front seat and tell people, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. I would assign the FRT, which is the rapid entry team. That always stood outside, so if somebody got in trouble, we had two people ready to go in and rescue somebody. The thing about Grand Canyon that was different from almost all other national park areas in the West is that we had thousands of buildings. I mean, I think it was like maybe 1,500 buildings. I
guess. Okay.
And because at that time, we responded to the town of Tucson.
Okay.
And so we were the fire department. There was no Tucson Fire Department when we first were there.
Right.
So we responded to lots and lots of structural fires as opposed to Sequoia National Park, which would have a structural fire in the park every other year.
Okay. Every other year. Right.
Every other year. So we not only – so I had a friend of mine, I think I mentioned before, the SAR cache, the search and rescue cache, caught on fire. And they're, even though they're level 2 firefighters, they have zero experience. So they do what is called a defensive attack, where they stay outside the fire and they just hit it with water.
Right.
When we, at the Grand Canyon, we became offensive firefighters, where we could then go inside with the hoses, with the tools, go up, cut the roofs, do, we could do all kinds of stuff that you see in the city.
Hmm.
And we did do it because we practice all the time. And then we got the call.
Okay.
And probably our most common call was a dumpster fire. And people think, well, dumpster fire, how stupid is that? People throw away their propane tanks,
ooh,
which can explode at any time. People throw away clothing that when they burn can give off cyanide gas. Wool gives off cyanide gas. So while it's not an emergency, all dumpster fires are considered urgent because you don't know if something's going to explode, what gas it's going to give off, whatever it is. And most dumpster fires were started by people taking their coals from their grill and throwing them in there rather than not throwing them in there.
Right.
And so they would smolder for a while or whatever. We did have some arson later on. But so you the good thing about dumpster fires, which we'd have a couple times a week, they were great practice because you'd still put everything on, you'd still buddy check with your person, you'd still have a tool, and you'd still, like a pike, you'd still pull out the 50-foot connect, and you'd open the lid and you'd shoot the water on the inside of the lid, so then it would drip down on what's inside. You just don't open the lid and look inside to get blown apart.
Mm-hmm.
You do all the precautions you need to do, and the pump operator would give you the amount that you needed, and then afterwards you'd stir everything up and pull everything out, and it was stinky business, but it's what we did. Then you'd go back and, you know, get undone and put your uniform back together and put your patrol stuff back on and get ready for the next call.
Right.
Didn't know what it was.
Right.
So we had a place in Grand Canyon across from Ranger Operations Building on Center Street, the library and the pub. And the pub was a sore place for a lot of people because it was where people went to get drunk. There wasn't much place for off-duty concession employees to go to mingle as a group. They either sat in their rooms or their stuff, but here they could go and they could play pool, they could do that. The problem is if you were a protection ranger, that they did come out drunk. And they did have fights and they did, you know, do property damage. So it was kind of a sore spot. We didn't want it there in some ways. Others wanted it there because they could make more arrests.
Oh, huh.
So that was the difference between day shift and night shift. So
okay.
On night shift in the summertime were people more tuned to being law enforcement.
Were you there when that building burned down?
That's the store I'm going to.
Okay, so what I'm thinking is we've been at this now for almost an hour.
Oh, and, good. So and we can do the library fire tomorrow.
I want to hear that story, but I think we should bundle it together.
yes,
yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and because that was... Was that 1997? When did that burn?
You know, before we come back, I will look it up.
Okay.
I will look it up and tell you when that burned.
All right, great. And the other question I've got for you, which I'm going to make a note of and you can think about, is you had mentioned in Death Valley you were seeing Kent.
Uh-huh.
And you were staying with him, and there was that was breaking some rules of you know, your...
It wasn't against the rules, but it wasn't right, I thought.
Yeah,
ethically.
It didn't look...
It wasn't ethical.
Yeah. So being... Now you're married. Was there any problem with you being on the structural fire team overseen by your husband?
Because he wasn't overseeing me. Remember, if it was Mike Myers in the early days, and later on we had shift supervisors.
Oh, okay.
So if it was a dumpster fire, it depended upon who was available to go on the dumpster fire. I might have been the captain engineer on the dumpster fire,
okay.
Would not go on that fire. So he didn't go on every single fire.
Okay.
But if it was a big structural fire, then I'll tell you what happened after. A lot changed after the recreation fire. For what I did on structure fires.
Okay.
But
all right, just thinking about that.
It was not a stovepipe. I did not work for Kent.
Okay.
He happened to be the fire chief, and he might have given out assignments, but then that was it.
Okay.
You know, and did the training and stuff. But no, it wasn't an issue at all, thank
goodness. Cool. I just want to check on that. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we got some things to talk about next time. And so I think with that, we'll conclude Part 6 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Malidi Meekum. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.